her guard down, just a little, and allowed herself to believe that she had just as much of a right to be here as anyone else. The thought caught her short. Did she really believe that? Well, yes, just a bit. She still felt an imposter, but maybe others did too. "I'm the token girl mathematician," Alison had admitted glumly, late one night as she pored over a textbook that might as well have been in Russian for all Holly could make of it, then drew a neat black line through her calculations. "Brought in to meet some gender quota." And then, "Oh, I feel such a fucking fraud." Holly was happy here, though. Her chest constricted and swelled in one fat throb as the thought reverberated through her. At Oxford, she could be entirely herself. Particularly here, in this library, where the whole point was that she could immerse herself in this womb of books and no longer have to pretend that she wasn't clever. At school she'd been consistently bullied for being bright, until she'd shrunk in on herself, no longer offering answers to the teacher's questions, hunching her shoulders and fixing her eyes on the floor as if to make herself invisible. If there was a crime worse than being bright, it was failing to disguise the fact under layers of sarcasm and thick mascara. At her school, the overriding aim was to get a boyfriend, and being clever could only militate against that. And then, in the final year, with it known that she would apply for Oxford, she had become defiant, had begun to speak up again, and to acknowledge her cleverness, though tentatively at first. "This is who I am," she effectively said, every time she found herself raising a hand to respond to Miss Thorogood's questions on free will and determinism in The Mill on the Floss, or on Bertha Rochester as Jane Eyre's doppelganger. She could see the end of school now, could count the remaining months and smell the freedom that soon would be hers, could sense the escape from the girlish cliques, the continual bitchiness, the insidious belief that if you weren't pretty or slim or wore a sufficiently short skirt or tucked in your tie in precisely the right way, skinny, with a fat tongue thrust between the top second and third buttons, you had no worth. On the last day of her exams, she had stalked into the Shakespeare paper, her thighs rubbing together under her frumpishly pleated skirt, her tie unashamedly fat, and she had written her heart out. Her worst tormentor, Tory Fox, had asked how she had found it, and she still hadn't dared to tell the truth, hadn't risked confessing. Actually, it was pretty easy. But when she got her four straight A's, they all knew. She stood up to stretch, and to glance out of the window again, at one of the finest views in Oxford. The Gothic Tower of St. Mary's offset by the classical Radcliffe Camera, a thrusting phallus of a spire outshone by a rotunda, study trumping worship, self-containment beating self-aggrandizement over and over again. Perhaps that was why she felt so content, here in this spot on the west side of this cobbled square, where she was surrounded by libraries with the square's centre showcasing the prettiest of them all. All of this beauty and history and tradition existed to celebrate and facilitate studying. She need never feel apologetic about wanting to read a book or be herself again. And so none of her social fears really mattered. She knew she would never be part of Sophie's clique, but perhaps it wasn't a huge issue. She had friends outside college, those earnest, ambitious boys on the student paper, who talked of applying for work experience on broadsheets or at the BBC, perhaps had even already done so. And Alison, with whom she could down a pint of cider in the college bar, and who she knew still unaccountably liked her, even if she was too inhibited when she dragged her to Park End Street nightclubs. Her clothes wrong, and her movements stilted, her body too gauche to really let herself go. She was free of the fear of being deemed wanting. For here, she was finally realizing, there were a few other people who were sufficiently different, enough for her to feel as if she could somehow fit in. For the first time in her life, or the first time since very early childhood, she belonged, and she could relax. the low-level anxiety that had coursed through her veins every day at school, and that had only ebbed away on the bus home as she sought comfort in a Twix, gobbled in a rush of relief at having survived another day, had disappeared, and would only surface intermittently when she sought Sophie out among her other friends. It was a new and completely wonderful feeling, this strong conviction, this sense of being happy and at ease. Chapter 16. Kate. 26th of April, 2017. Day 3, and Olivia Lytton looks more as if she's dressed for a job interview. Gone is the Peter Pan collar. In its place, a crisp white shirt and well-cut navy jacket and skirt. Her hair, which she repeatedly tucked behind her ear yesterday, has been held back with a nest of grips. The effect is to make her look both younger and less elegant. Her cheekbones are more pronounced. She is less attractive, more severe. She's even paler this morning. I would guess that she's barely slept, and her eyes are lit by an artificial brightness powered by adrenaline and the bitter filter coffee bought from the court's canteen. Olivia's eyes have hardened. Ali, in a rare undiplomatic moment, once told me that no one could properly understand the pain of giving birth until they'd experienced it. In the same way, Olivia could not hope to predict quite how terrifying giving evidence would be. Despite the court's best efforts to be gentle, I know a few chief witnesses in sexual offences cases who have managed to come through this experience unscathed. The court is nearly full now. I rearrange my side of the bench, building a fortress with bundles of documents, neatly aligned pens, a jug and glass for water, defending myself with books and files as the jury settle themselves into their now familiar positions, and a clutch of journalists, not just the jaded court reporter from the news agency with his shiny suit and greasy tie, but the safe hands from the broadsheets and tabloids, sidle onto the press benches and fling their pads down. Jim Stevens from the Chronicle is here, an old-school hack fueled by beer and fags, his face puce beneath that raven black hair that perhaps comes from a bottle. One of the few who remember working on Fleet Street when it was Fleet Street. It would be easy to dismiss him compared to the hungry graduate trainees working alongside him. But I read him, and I rate him. For the third day, Sophie Whitehouse hasn't arrived. "Done a runner," Angela Regan whispers, her mouth set in a line of condemnation. My junior, Tim Sharples, a languid fellow with a good line in black humour, catches my eye. I look at the QC sharply. "Scarpered off to her mother's in Devon." Her tone is grim. This doesn't look good for her client, this pointed continual absence of his wife. I busy myself with searching for a document in a ring binder, double-checking out of a needless nervousness, biting back the trace of a smile that Angela, a street fighter of an opponent, must know is playing across my face. And then there's a hush, which grows into a heavy cushion of silence. The rustles stop, and all I can hear is the rhythmic ticking of the clock. We are all poised. I stand, an actor on a stage, until His Lordship indicates that we should get started. I turn to Olivia, for it is time to draw her on now, to tell the heart of her story. "Can I take you back to October the 13th? I say, my voice moderate and reasonable. "The date in question. I think you were due to attend the Home Affairs Select Committee together." "Yes. James was due to give evidence on the new countering extremism strategies we were about to start implementing." In everyday English, I think those are ways in which the government aims to stop potential terrorists. "Yes." She straightens, for she's on safe territory here. Civil servant speak, which is uncontentious. "Normally this would be evidence given in private to the Intelligence Select Committee, but there was a slight turf war between the committee chairs." "I think the meeting was first thing in the morning. So what time did you set off?"
"Just before 9. James was jittery,
and said that he wanted to talk to me over a coffee. I pushed my glasses up my nose and turned to look at the jury. The officious middle-aged man, his belly straining against his iron shirt and a smart navy tie on today, smiles, anticipating my next question, for it is a courtly dance I'm playing here, and the jury is beginning to predict my every move. You say he was jittery. Why was that? There'd been an unfavourable comment piece in The Times. It was by a journalist he knew and rated, a contemporary from Oxford. He thought he liked him. It was quite poisonous, and he didn't seem able to laugh it off, like he usually did. He kept repeating the most damaging phrases as if he couldn't shake them from his mind. I think we have the article in question here. I flipped the relevant page in my file. I think you'll find it's document 3 in your bundle of evidence. A rustle of action and a frisson of excitement among the jury at being asked to do something. Frankly, I'm amazed the judge has ruled the article admissible. It's so potentially prejudicial. But I argued it is relevant because it prompted James Whitehouse's anger before the alleged rape and explains his state of mind. Here it is. I hold the document in my left hand, brandishing it firmly and looking around for confirmation. It's from the Times of that morning, October the 13th, and it's written by a Mark Fitzwilliam. He's a comment writer on that paper. It's about the impact of the terror legislation, but the part we're interested in starts at the second paragraph, and you may think constitutes an attack on the defendant. I glance at Angela, but she lets this go, as discussed pre-trial. We're all agreed the article is pretty bloody damning. I clear my throat. If I may begin, when James Whitehouse came into government, many hoped he would be a fresh broom to sweep aside some of our more draconian anti-terror legislation. But the close personal friend of the Prime Minister and long-standing member of his kitchen cabinet has surpassed his predecessor by rampaging through our nation's civil liberties like a member of the Libertine Club intent on trashing an Oxford restaurant, smashing its windows, defacing its walls, soiling its carpet with magnum upon magnum of wasted, emptied champagne. As a member of the notorious dining club, James Whitehouse was famed for his breathtakingly arrogant disregard of those who owned or worked in such establishments. Why should he care about the disruption, the grievance, the headache of righting the chaos he and his friends had wreaked, when a fistful of £50 notes would always provide a ready solution? Born with a silver spoon in his mouth, he had no insight into the effect of his behaviour on those whose livelihoods he trashed. In the same way, this old Etonian shows a blatant disregard for the impact of the anti-terror legislation on law-abiding British Muslims that he champions now. I pause. You say he was a bit jittery. Is it fair to say that this article also made him angry? Your Lordship, Angela rises, for I'm leading the witness. I'm sorry, Your Lordship. I bow to the judge. Let me rephrase the question. Could you describe Mr. Whitehouse's response to this article more fully? He was angry, Olivia confirms. She deliberates, and I catch a glimpse of the thoughtful young woman who would have been destined for a good career before it was derailed by sex. Short with me, but also somehow seeking reassurance. It was as if he'd forgotten the distance that he'd put between us and wanted to recapture our closeness. It was clear that this had affected him sharply. He seemed vulnerable for once. It affected him sharply. How could you tell this? His body language was stiff, ramrod straight, and I had to half run to keep up with him. Usually he brushed off any criticism, but as we marched to the committee room, he kept repeating phrases as if it had really got under his skin. If I can stop you, what time was this? at about 9:15? Normally the minister would sweep in just before the start, so he didn't have to chat to the back benchers unless he wanted to. And he didn't want to that morning. When he saw the committee members huddled together outside Room 15, the Lloyd George room, and glancing at him as he arrived, he said something like, "I can't deal with this," and he charged off down the corridor in the other direction. "That's towards the press gallery to the east." There's a rustle of the jurors' folders. "Yes, that's right. It is." I direct the jurors to the relevant map, another corridor stretching away from the central staircase and leading to our crime scene, for which they also have photographs. An unprepossessing, brown, carpeted lift. "And what did you do when he charged off like this?"
"I followed him."
"You followed him?" I pause, letting the fact sink in, and the implication that she was just being a good employee, attentive to her minister. "He said, 'I can't deal with this,' stormed off, and you followed him." I tilt my head to one side, sympathetic. "Can you remember what he said?"
"He was still muttering under his breath, and then he stopped by the door leading to the press gallery and the lift, and turned to me and said, 'I'm not breathtakingly arrogant, am I? Do you think I'm arrogant?'"
And Olivia stops abruptly, for she's like a runner who's been pushing herself to exceed her personal best, and finds she has surpassed herself and is breathless, her face flushed, her energy almost spent. "And what did you say when he said that?" I keep my voice matter-of-fact and glance down at my open file as if the answer is of no particular significance. "I said he could be ruthless when he needed to be, cruel sometimes even."
"And how did he respond?"
"He didn't like it. Cruel," he said, "and then, 'I'm sorry.'"
"And what did you say to that?"
I ask, for we can all imagine how she felt, the jilted lover who finally receives the long-awaited apology.
"I said," and her voice dips, but the court is quiet. We're all straining to capture her every word, and they are words that could damn her.
"I said that sometimes arrogance could be devastatingly attractive." On we march through the evidence that could be construed as damaging. He flings open the door from the committee room corridor to the press gallery, stops outside the lift, presses the button, and she enters first. "And what happened next?"
"We kissed. Well, we sort of collided."
"You sort of collided?"
"I suppose we both moved together at the same time."
"You moved together at the same time?" There was a strong attraction there, then, although he had finished with you, that was the term I think you used, just over a week earlier.
"We had been involved for 5 months. We had been lovers."
And here she looks at me, a little defiant, and I wonder what she thinks of me. If she imagines me as a woman who has never known an irresistible sexual attraction, that melding of mouths and limbs, the jigsawing of bodies that shrinks one's world to just the two of you, and in those most intimate moments makes the rest of the world disappear. I smile, waiting for her to continue, for this is what the jury needs to hear to understand, how she got herself into this situation in the first place. They need to sense her emotional confusion, to appreciate that despite feeling humiliated and bruised by his treatment, she could not fail to respond when the man she loved so passionately moved towards her for a kiss.
"You don't just switch off your feelings for someone when they finish with you. Not after that short a time. Not if you'd wanted it to continue," she says. "Or at least I don't. I still found him very attractive. I still loved him."
"Can you describe the kiss?" I need to push her on this. She looks blank. "Was it a
chaste peck on the lips?
No, she looks at me, perturbed. I smile.
Well, is there a word you might use to describe it?
She looks embarrassed.
I suppose you would call it French kissing.
French kissing?
You know, passionate kissing, with tongues.
So you kissed with tongues, and can you remember what happened then?
His hands were all over me, touching my breasts and my bottom.
She falters. And then? I probe gently.
Then he wrenched at the top buttons of my shirt to get into my bra, to my breasts.
I pause, letting the room take in her humiliation, the casual violence of the moment. Perhaps I seem cold, pushing her to relive it all, and yet I'm not. I can imagine all too clearly, and I want the jury to imagine what she felt then and what she's feeling now.
Can we take this in stages? He was touching your breasts and bottom and wrenched your shirt to get into your bra.
Did he get into it?
Yes. She's close to tears. He grabbed one of my breasts, my left breast, pulled it out of my bra and began to kiss and bite it.
She nods and swallows.
He kissed it quite savagely.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that he gave me a love bite, but quite a harsh one.
I think you received a bruise as a result, just above your left nipple. She nods, close to weeping. In fact, we have a photograph which you took on your iPhone later that week. It's a photograph A in your bundles, I tell the jury, and I hold an A4-sized photo up for them to see. It shows a fat green gauge of a bruise, 2 centimetres by 3, a yellowy brown by this stage, less angry than the reddish-black it must have been in the immediate aftermath of the attack. If you look closely on the left of the bruise, I tell the jury, my tone ever so matter-of-fact, you can see a slight indentation. The defence's case is that this is a usual discoloration on a bruise, but the Crown submits, and here I pause and shake my head ever so slightly, the Crown submits that they are caused by teeth. I wait for the inevitable gasp. The jurors don't disappoint. Several glance at the dock, and Essex boy eyeballs James Whitehouse clearly, chocolate eyes not moving from his face. And where were you when this happened? I go on, for I must continue before Olivia loses momentum.
In the lift. It's a tiny wooden lift. It says it can hold 6 people, but it can't possibly. I had my back to the wall and he was in front of me, so I was pushed, well, trapped against it. I couldn't move past.
You couldn't move, but you must have done something.
I think I yelped in shock and tried to push him. I said something like, that hurt me, and then, no, not here.
You said, no, not here. And why was that?
A kiss in a lift was one thing, something I found exciting, but this was different, too full-on, too aggressive. He might have meant the bite to be passionate, but it shocked me. It was painful, not something he'd ever done before, and it wasn't appropriate. He had yanked my breasts out and bitten me, but we were meant to be preparing for a select committee. The lift runs from the press gallery to New Palace Yard, where the minister's cars wait. It's a shortcut to the committee room corridor. Anyone could have called the lift at any moment and found us there.
So would it be fair to say that you were scared of being discovered?
Yes.
And that you were preoccupied with being late for the meeting?
Yes, but it was more than that. I hadn't known him to be as forceful as this, and he seemed not to be listening. A little like he was a man possessed.
Like a man possessed.
I pause, as the reporters keep their heads down, their headlines and their opening paragraph written for them now. And as the judge takes a note, his black parka scrolling. The pen stops, and so I can begin again. So, in this state, what did he do when you said, not here, and tried to push him away?
He ignored me and grabbed my thighs and my bottom.
She stops, and I tilt my head to one side. A picture of sympathy, for the evidence is going to get even grubbier now, the detail more embarrassing and explicit, and yet we need to hear it. The jury senses it too. Some of them are leaning forward. All of us are rapt, knowing that the kernel of this case, the evidence that my learned friend will dispute and seek to undermine in cross-examination, will be found bound hard and tight in her next words. And what happened then?
He tugged at my skirt so that it rode over my bottom and up, round my waist. Then he thrust his hand between my legs.
If I can ask you to be a bit more specific, you say he thrust his hand between your legs.
On my vagina.
I wait 3 beats. He thrust his hand on your vagina. My voice softens, quietens, becomes as gentle as cashmere as I wait for the impact of her words to resound around the court. And what happened then? I say it so quietly.
He pulled at my tights and knickers and yanked them down. I remember hearing the tights laddering and the elastic on my knickers ripping.
If I may stop you there, we have a photograph of the knickers as evidence. If you look at photograph B in your bundle, I tell the jury, you can see the ripped elastic. A flurry of turned pages and a photograph of a wisp of black lacy nylon, the sort of knickers a lover might wear. The waistband at the top is frayed. The seam pulled loose at the top of the pants, as if they'd been wrenched in a hurry. It's not incontrovertible evidence, and the defence will argue they were already ripped. But I feel a rush of sympathy for Olivia, who will never have envisaged that her underwear would be poured over like this, or make it into print. She's flushing now, crimson blooming on her cheeks, and I push on, for the evidence will only get harder, her experience worse. So, he yanks down your tights and knickers. And what happened then?
Then he put his fingers, two of his fingers, his middle and his index, I think, inside me.
And what happened then? She looks outraged that I'm so relentless.
I struggled and tried to push him off again, to tell him to get off me. But my back was to the lift wall. His weight was pushing against me, and he just wasn't listening to me.
So he had two of his fingers inside you. I pause and speak only to her for a moment, deepening my voice, indicating that I know that the next part will be difficult. And what happened next?
I realised his flies were undone and his boxers were pulled down and I saw his, well, I saw his penis poking out.
Was it flaccid or erect at this point? Her look is one of intense shame that she has to point this out. I tilt my head and remain impassive. Her voice dips.
Erect,
she manages to say. And still I push on. And what happened then?
He sort of lifted me up against the wall and he shoved it inside me, she says. and her voice cracks with pain and perhaps relief that she's got the worst over. He just shoved it inside me, even though I had said I didn't want it.
You said that again, here.
I said something like, not his. Someone might see us.
Just to be clear, you indicated that you didn't want this. You said, not here.
Yes.
She is emphatic. And what did he say?
He said...
And her voice breaks now, and she can barely get the words out, they're so painful.
He said... He whispered.
Still a pause. And then out the sentence floods, and her voice rings clear, though I anticipated a whisper.
He said, don't be such a prick, Tease.
The words whip around the court. The C and T, two hard consonants that smash into the silence. And then?
He just kept going.
He whispered, don't be such a prick, Tease, and he just kept going. I repeat, more in sorrow than in anger, and I pause, letting the jury take in her unrestrained sobs that now fill the windowless courtroom, soaring up to the ceiling and bouncing off those oak benches with their fur-green leather seats. The judge looks down while he waits for her to compose herself. The jurors put their pens down and lean back. One of the older women, sensible short grey hair, a wide open face, looks close to tears, while the youngest, a slight dark-haired woman who I imagine is a student, watches, her face shrouded in the most exquisite pity. They wait, and they tell her with their silence that they have plenty of time. Olivia is not in a position to answer calmly just yet, but it doesn't matter. Those tears and our understanding silence will prove more eloquent than anything she has to say. Judge Luckhurst looks at me and Angela from over the top of his spectacles as her sobs become louder and more ugly, a throaty cascade that shows little immediate sign of abating, although she wipes ferociously at her eyes.
Perhaps this might be a good time to adjourn, he suggests, his voice gentle. If I could see you back here in 20 minutes, at 11 o'clock.
He is gracious to the jury. His clerk, Nikita, stands as he does.
Silence! Be upstanding in court!
I am trembling when I reach the bar mess to grab a few moments in which to compose myself. Olivia did well. I could not have hoped that she would have done better, although I can predict the points that Angela will push at in her cross-examination. The bruise, a sign of passion, not violence. The prick tease jibe. Is she sure she remembered correctly that it wasn't just a tease, something that might be whispered lovingly? Those words, not here, someone might see us. Not, as I had hoped she would elaborate, though it was not there in her initial evidence, a more emphatic, unequivocal no. The CPS solicitor, Jenny Green, appeared pleased outside court, and I think Olivia will have played well to his lordship, although the decision, of course, is not his. I should feel buoyed with relief, but the adrenaline is rushing from me, and I feel momentarily drained. The inevitable anticlimax, perhaps, after a good performance. But there's also something else beyond this, and the low-lying anger that helps power me through such evidence. A residual sadness that hijacks me like a stubborn bully I cannot shift. I slump in my chair and take a swig from a bottle of water, tepid now and tasting of nothing. My cuticles, I notice, are ragged. I need to put myself physically back together. I cannot let myself slip. Just 1 minute of introspection and then I must refocus. I close my eyes, wallowing in the dizzying blackness, shutting out the sound of my fellow barristers bustling in, and try to draw on my inner strength, that shard of steel that my ex-husband Alistair once insisted I had instead of a heart. How little he really knew me.
How little anyone knows me except perhaps Ali. I see Olivia in that lift and shove aside the memory of someone else.
Looking thoughtful, Kate.
Angela, her grey eyes sharp in her doughy face, is brisk as she sweeps aside a paper cup half filled with cold coffee and slams down her slab of papers. The room is filled with a bustle of counsel scouring laptops, analysing court papers, or reliving the horror of representing certain defendants. By this point he'd drunk 14 pints of lager and a bottle of vodka. But he's important, so that's his defence. I'm aware that Angela's eyes are still on my face. Her presence, her papers, her laptop, her capacious bag plonked right opposite me, feels oppressive.
Always thinking, Angela, I retort, for my learned friend is ruthless in court and I can't betray any weakness.
I push away from the table to escape the fetid smell of the room, canteen food congealing on a plate, the windows need opening, and prepare for the next part of the case. Sometimes, I think, as I shuffle my papers together, ensuring that the documents are just so, the jurors must question how I can pry like this. How I can probe into the most distressing moments of a woman's life and appear so very detached. How I can niggle away at the details. Where exactly did he place his fingers? How many? For how long? Where was his penis? Was it erect or flaccid at this point? A pause, just to exploit her anguish. And what did he do then? Where is your milk of human kindness? That's something Alistair also hurled at me as our 18-month-long marriage imploded. A casualty not just of my inability to open up to him, and of too many late nights working, but an obsession in arguments with being utterly ruthless in winning each point. I know that, in the early days, I thought I had to just keep the questions coming until I ground the witness down and unearth the salient fact. That's fine if it's the defendant in the box. But how can I do this to another woman? Reduce her to a humiliated heap of messy tears? I do it because I want to get at the truth. And by getting at the truth, I can do my best to ensure each rapist or murderer or abuser is convicted. I can't guarantee it. That decision lies with the jurors. But I do everything I can to ensure that's the case. And how do I deal with knowing and repeating and rehearsing such graphic details? From mouths and tongues that probe unwanted, to a penis rammed into each and every orifice, for hands on breasts or even vaginas are at the milder end of the continuum of what I hear. I deal with it just as a detective or a forensic pathologist or a social worker does, or should. I practice detachment, developing a neutral facade that is as much of a disguise as any gown or wig. Of course, it doesn't mean that I don't feel. I just choose to contain that emotion, or rather to channel it into righteous anger, cold, forensic, focused, rather than the white-hot rage that would boil over if I gave it half a chance. His hand was on your vagina, I repeat, keeping my voice disinterested and low. A pause, and she confirms it. I wait 3 beats. And what happened then? To be fair, I sometimes wonder why so many of us women allow ourselves to wander so directly into the path of danger. Why return to a man who's made an unwanted advance, or sent a text with a kiss or a smiley face emoji? Why engage when it's the last thing you feel? But the truth is, women are often scared of antagonizing their assailants, or they may feel conflicted. Not so very long ago, they may have been charmed by them. And we women aim to please. It's hardwired into us that we should placate and mollify, bend our will to that of men. Oh, some of us have fought against that, and we're seen as hard-nosed, difficult, assertive, shrewish. We pay the penalty. Why don't I have a proper live-in partner? It's not just because I'm unsure if I can trust anyone sufficiently. It's because I refuse to compromise. I refuse to woman up, you might say. And so, yes,
A young woman whose boss has touched her up, or whose supposed friend has kissed her, might well seek to minimise what has happened, to think the best, that it was an out-of-character mistake, best forgotten or brushed over, whatever the pounding of her heart and the shot of fear coursing through her might betray. But she is a fool, and it is no wonder. Men can make fools of us all.
Chapter 17. James. The 16th of January, 1993. They had reached this stage of the evening when it was imperative that they empty the restaurant of all of the champagne on the premises. That, to James's increasingly inebriated mind, made complete and utter sense. "Here, Jackson." He leaned back in the elegant dining chair and gesticulated to the maitre d' of the Cock restaurant, who looked as if he was having a tough night, though why, when he would be amply reimbursed for any damage the libertines might commit, James couldn't for the life of him understand. He flung a strong arm around the man's shoulders and hugged him, to Jackson's apparent discomfort. Having your gaff wrecked by the libs was a badge of honour among Oxford restaurant staff. Or it should be. Part of university folklore. Tradition. James was a strong believer in tradition. Or rather, he was when he had drunk such an excessive amount he needed something as concrete as this to hold on to, rather than grasping at more nebulous concepts and sounding vacuous. He didn't drink excessively these days. Rowing precluded that. You didn't become an athlete, a stroke for the men's heavyweight blue boat, by sating your body with alcohol, nor by shirking training or ergo practice, thanks to the mother of all hangovers, something he would experience tomorrow, he knew. Which was why it made sense to stop the drinking now and dispose of the remaining Bollinger by some other means. No use leaving anything for other punters to drink, not that any other punters would be visiting this fine establishment in the immediate future. Perhaps they had rather trashed it. His shoe slithered on a sliver of glass beneath his chair as he took in the table strewn with smashed goblets, domes fractured into shards, splinters dusting the lone bread basket and glinting on the pats of butter. The plates, slick with gravy from the duck, had been whisked away, but the side plates had been smashed, Tom standing on a chair and Cassius on the table, which creaked as it took his hefty weight, holding the crockery up high and then throwing them down like a bunch of Greek tourists. Jackson and his staff, including two young waitresses who looked at them wide-eyed, had left the debris, jagged pieces of china and finer pairings. He supposed it made sense to wait until they'd seen the full extent of their destruction. The clutter now looked pitiful, though those crashes had been satisfyingly noisy at the time. His stomach fizzed. That would be the Burgundy on top of the champers, the duck and the Dover sole. God, he felt sick. A physical nausea and also something verging on self-disgust or distaste. Of course his body would bounce back from this night of excess, but he was proud of its definition. Those abs made getting laid with whomever he wanted a foregone conclusion. He slid his hands under his waistcoat to surreptitiously check his definition was still there. "This won't do," Tom, more bladdered than usual, more intoxicated than James, was weaving his way towards him, hips banging against the edge of the table, his broad, pleasant face a cheery red. You wouldn't know there was a sharp brain beneath the sheen of his skin and that foppish hair. He was on course for a double first, for he had the critical ability to judge the exact amount of work required to excel. James had shared tutorials with Tom in the summer term of their second year, a time he had spent rowing, punting, and, pre-Sophie, getting laid with as many different girls as possible, and had relied on Tom heavily, but had still been surprised by the extent to which his friend had blagged it. Neither of them frequented the union, old fogies, has-beens who never had been, in Tom's words, but despite this, he sensed that Tom, with a place lined up at the Conservative Research Department post-finals, could do as he intended and forge a stellar political career. Not that you would think it now.
"This won't do at all."
Tom slammed the flat of his palm down on the table with a frenzied beam, then sniffed. He had snorted several lines of coke, which helped explain his uncharacteristic volubility.
"We need more champers, don't we, Jackson?"
He clamped the maitre d' in a forceful hug.
More champers! More champers! More bolly! We need more bolly, and we need it now!
There was a general braying of agreement from George, Nicholas, and the Honourable Alec, the chaps at their end of the table, and a rallying cry from the other end where Hal was dozing on the floor, his midnight blue tails dusted with glass, his shirt rucked up from its waistband to expose a delicate, pale arc of stomach flopping out. A dark stain bloomed at his crotch, and he gave a low and fruity belch.
"Let's not drink it," James offered a note of caution. "Let's waste it."
Tom's face broke into a smile of comprehension.
"Go on, Jackson. All the bolly. All the bolly, olly, olly. Let's drink it, and then let's piss it up the walls."
The maitre d' put his hands up in a mild plea.
"Come on, man. What's the problem?"
Tom protested, as Nicholas roared and George undid his flies, preparing to take him literally.
"We won't really piss it. Put your todger back, George. We'll pour it away."
And they half hustled, half jostled the man to the champagne fridge, and watched as he withdrew the remaining 10 bottles to add to the 20 already quaffed.
"Come on, man."
George, his penis stuffed back in his pants, the zip hastily pulled up, was in hectoring mood.
"Open it! Open it! Open it! Christ, what's wrong with you? Talk about fumbling!" "And pour it away!"
Tom roared as Jackson, his hands shaking as he fiddled with the muselet, finally popped the first cork and began to empty it down the kitchen sink, the bubbles fizzing against the stainless steel. One of the waitresses ducked away, but the elder, a dark-haired girl, pretty in an obvious sort of way, stood by her boss, handing over bottle after bottle, her face rigid with disapproval. Small-minded pettiness. Well, bugger her. She was never likely to be able to do the same.
"And the next," James cried. "Come on, my good man."
He stood close to the maitre d', conscious of towering over this slight man, 5'8" at most, and of the potential threat of his presence. He stepped back a little. No need to be thuggish. It wasn't his style. The plate-smashing and window-breaking he accepted as inevitable, part of the tradition of the libertines, the havoc central to the ethos of the club, the general sense of entitlement and invincibility over those who had attended minor public school, who had been to comprehensives, and whom he barely knew and certainly never mixed with. But there was no need to be boorish. He left that to the likes of Hal and Freddy, who were coarse in their brutality. Could not conceive of being civil as they were recklessly violent. James always made sure he apologised profusely for their destruction, was the first to whip out his fistful of notes and collate the money to compensate for their damage. Courtesy costs nothing, his mother had always taught him, and did much to ease problems and endear oneself.
"And the next," chorused Tom, Nick and Alec. "All the bolly, all the bolly, all the bolly, all the bolly."
Their voices surged into one great roar as they stomped over the broken crockery and swayed against the burgundy velvet curtains, which Cassius grasped, the velvet falling over him like the end of an act as the pole was wrenched from the wall.
"Gentlemen, please."
Jackson's face was stretched tight, his voice fraught with panic as he glanced at the chunk of plaster protruding above the pole and the flakes of paint snowing down.
"Whoops!"
Tom, as delighted as an errant schoolboy, beamed, then turned to the maitre d' with the solicitude that would allow him to smooth many political differences in the future.
"I'm terribly sorry, my dear man. We will, of course, reimburse you."
Jackson still looked unsettled, but demurred, exhaustion glazing his face. The awareness that his restaurant would be out of action for a few days, and the upheaval this would require, apparently registering, though James was sure they had trashed it before.
"All the bolly! All the bolly!"
Alec, coked up as usual, continued to chant, and they jostled their way to the kitchen, and the mass uncorking. Like effervescent urine, it frothed and foamed, fizzing down the plug hole in one long golden stream.
"In years to come..."
Tom flung a conspiratorial arm around his best friend.
"We will be able to say we were rich enough to pour our bolly away. Gilded youths, yeah?"
He gave a discreet belch, then laughed and pressed his wet lips to James's cheek. James extricated himself, not drunk enough to enjoy being kissed by Tom. He thought of other lips.
"We need some women."
The need was urgent.
"Women?"
Tom shook his head.
The trouble with women is they're such fucking hard work. George bent over a line of coke he had managed to assemble on the table, threw back his head and laughed.
"Spike their drinks," said Sebastian. "Get them so mullet there's no need for foreplay."
James shivered. "Not my scene. I like them to appreciate what I'm doing."
"Jim doesn't need that," Cassius drawled as he watched him with barely concealed envy. "Touch of the Errol Flynn about him."
James shrugged. No need to deny or confirm Cassius's supposition. Hung like a Vittel bottle, as a girl once said.
"Extra double shots of vodka," Seb persisted. "That's what the rest of us have to do if we're not going to stick to buggery. Spike their drink and fuck 'em hard."
He emptied his glass in three swift gulps, his Adam's apple bobbing furiously, then looked at James directly, his pale eyes in his pudgy, still unformed face, fixed, hoping for a reaction.
"Or slash their bike tires so they can't get away. No choice but to stay and get fucked."
James didn't smile. For a second, he felt revulsion towards this Christchurch man, the wealthiest member of the club. His family had made millions through retail, but the one he knew the least about, his new money of too shiny a lustre and not as trustworthy as the old money that bankrolled most of them. Then he shrugged. Seb was callow, a sexually inexperienced first year, trying too hard to be a man, but he was harmless, no? The boy smiled, rubbery lips pulled tight, but his eyes still cold, and again James felt a shiver of unease. A need to distance himself, perhaps to get more drunk or high if he couldn't go out and find himself a woman. To seek a fresh sensation that wouldn't just distract, but overwhelm him. He nodded to George and, for once, bowed to the inevitable, snorting up the clean, sharp coke, then waiting for the hit, and Christ, it was good, and he felt good. He felt fucking invincible. What was he doing, listening to Seb's shit, when he could go and get a girl now? More doing, less talking, because he was fucking gorgeous, wasn't he? They all knew it, the Libertines, Soph, and every other girl in Oxford. He was a fucking love god, and he could go for hours, hung like a Vittel bottle, with the stamina of a rower, the tongue of a lizard, the lips of Jagger... Well, no, not Jagger, fucking ugly bloke. But he was shit hot in bed, he knew that, and he was funny too, he was a fucking catch. And much as he loved these guys, well, loved Tom at least, there were places to go, girls to see, the night was young, and there was a whole night of loving ahead of him if he could scale Soph's college wall, the spikes by the bike shed, and hammer on her door, or find someone fresh. Because that was what he craved right now, a new mouth, new breasts, new legs to wrap around his waist or cradle his ears, a new way of whimpering when she came, because of course she would come, this imaginary new girl who was replete with possibility, because he was shit-hot in bed, hung like a Vittel bottle. A giggle. Not the manly laugh he was known for, but something younger and more joyful. His laugh as a 7-year-old before he was sent off to prep school and learned to man up, slipped out. A laugh of complicity and intimacy because he loved these guys just as he loved his girls, didn't he? Well, no, not quite in the same way as he loved girls. He wasn't gay, for God's sake, but he did love Tom. His best friend since their first year at school. He'd do anything for him. Well, almost anything. God, how he loved him. He'd tell him now just how very much he loved him. His dearest friend, the best of chaps. "Here, Tom." He flung his arms around his shoulders and pulled him to him, proffered the kiss that he'd shunned from his friend earlier. "Let's go get some women."
"Women.
The trouble with women is..." Tom began.
"Yeah, yeah, I know. The trouble with women is they're such fucking hard work."
He finished. And that giggle emerged again, high-pitched and joyful, because it was fucking funny. He was fucking funny. Why didn't they all realise how funny he was?
"The trouble with women is," Tom repeated, "they've got no backbone."
"No,"
Tom looked confused, "they've got no cock."
"Well, that can be rectified," he sniggered.
"The trouble with women..."
The answer was so blindingly obvious, James couldn't help but butt in, his laughter blasting the words straight out of him.
"The trouble with women is they don't know what the fuck they want."
He doubled over and thought. Now, why aren't the others laughing? Instead of smashing plates, or in Seb's case, trying to grope that poor girl. Pretty in an obvious way.
skirt up to her ass, forehead crinkling as if she was seriously pissed off with him. The Seb was harmless. Well, he was pretty sure he was harmless, and she was dressed as if she was asking for it, skirt up to her ass and blouse cut low.
Ow!
The girl squealed, and her black eyes glared at Seb, who must have pinched her bum. He was looking so sheepish and holding his hands up in the air as if he was innocent, though he'd clearly sidled up behind her.
"Gentlemen, you will have to leave, I'm afraid."
Jackson's face was crumpling in on itself like a rotting plum as he came towards Seb, and it occurred to James that the girl might be his daughter. They had the same eyes, hard, dark blackberries and a Clafferty face, and he looked as if he wanted to hit him.
"I really must insist that you leave the premises. Enough is enough. I mean it now. Enough is enough."
He pulled himself up to his full height, and for a moment, the air shimmered with the possibility of violence, a tension that radiated between the maitre d' and Seb, taut and tight. No one spoke. The tension spreading throughout the candle-lit room as James tried to work out how the atmosphere had changed quite so quickly from something fun and jovial, the good-humoured destruction of the libs who were gents, really they were, to this, something rather distasteful and socially awkward, the very opposite of the atmosphere they always managed to create. He opened his mouth as he tried to think of something suitably solicitous, but Tom stepped in.
"My dear man, of course we will. 1,000 apologies. Do tell us what we owe you."
And then to Seb,
"Come on, man, let's get some air. Time to call it a night, eh? Time to go home."
But Seb was having none of it.
"What the fuck? A chap pays a girl a compliment, tells her she's a bit of a looker. Though I take that back. I take that back right now. And she objects. Can't take it. Can't take a compliment. What rot. What fucking rot."
He looked around, incredulous, and for one terrible moment it looked as if his eyes were filling with tears.
"My good man."
James was stuffing notes into the maitre d's hand. £100, £200, £300. Not enough to touch the damage, but enough, hopefully, to distract him.
"It's fucking rot, I say."
Seb would not be quiet and wasn't going to be ushered out gently, and suddenly there was a smash and a silvering of yet more glass as he lifted a chair and, before any of them realised quite what was happening, hurled it through the window and out into the street.
"Ha!"
Into the dazed silence came a whoop from Hal's end of the room, where the Honourable Alec began clapping, slowly at first, but then ferociously.
"Bloody good show, man! Bloody good show!"
But it wasn't, was it? As George and Nick and Cassius and a dopey Hal, roused by the explosion of noise, joined in the applause and in the destruction, and Jackson moved into the foyer towards the restaurant's phone, James locked eyes with Tom. A night in the cells wasn't an option. Would be a crushing embarrassment. They were invincible, yes, but neither of them needed this. And here he was dimly aware of the coke affecting his usually measured thinking, it would be them, wouldn't it? The libs who, Icarus-like, flew closest to the sun. Far better to slip away now, to let the younger chaps, those wreaking havoc now and smashing more glasses, and, oh God, George was getting his cock out again while Hal was parking a tiger, a thick stream of vomit splaying from his flabby lips, take the rap. All this was transmitted in one quick glance, a locking of eyes that required no further confirmation, and then they scarpered, slipping from the scene as Jackson was on the phone to the police, and the poor waitress stood cowering beside him, flattening herself against the wall as they squeezed past. James mouthed a sorry, for it cost nothing to be civil, his mother always said. It helped smooth things over, for no one wanted any difficulty. And then they were out, into the freezing January night.
"Fucking hell."
Tom ran his hands through his light brown fringe. A compulsive gesture James recognised from his rare moments of high tension. The time, aged 17, when he'd thought he'd got a girlfriend back home pregnant. That late afternoon at school when they'd been caught smoking spliffs, and for a brief moment in the headmaster's study it looked as if they would be expelled.
"Shh!"
His warning ended with a giggle.
"I know. Fucking hell."
Horror and delight, shock and awe were caught in his voice, and then they were off, as a distant police siren began to wail up St. Aldate's towards them and down the high.
"We are invincible, fucking invincible," James thought.
And then they're getting closer, as they raced the Sound, coattails flying, hearts thudding, legs burning as if straining to do the mother of all ergos, or the final torturous length of a rowing race. His heart was throbbing against his ribs, this great muscle that never let him down, and he flew one last surge of energy, pushing him over the cobbles until they were there, had reached the sanctity of Tom's College, Walsingham.